Hello, Lifebookers. Today's episode of the podcast is a special sneak preview of the Life Improvement Podcast, a show we've been kicking around for a while at Lifebook. And since you guys are members, you get to hear it before it launches. So I did this interview with Noah Rashetta. He hosts the Secular Buddhism Podcast. It's an amazing interview, and I know you're going to love it. So happy Spiritual Month, all you Lifebook members. We love each and every one of you. Without further ado, I want to thank you for listening. Please enjoy the show. Hello, podcast listeners. You are now listening to the Life Improvement Podcast, brought to you by Lifebook. I'm your host, Jordan River, and I want to thank you for tuning in today. What a great guest we have on the phone. Person that's near and dear to my heart. I hear him every day. His podcast going in my house, the Secular Buddhism Podcast. Host Noah Rashetta is here. How you doing, Noah?
Doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, man. Well, right at the top of the show, I want to congratulate you on making such an awesome podcast. You really connect with your listeners, man, and present Buddhism in a way that is really unique and digestible. And I just want to congratulate you on making such a good show as a podcast listener myself.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And you've also got two great books out, No Nonsense Buddhism for Beginners. I've got a copy of that in my studio, actually. And then your newest one is the 5-Minute Mindfulness Journal. Tell us about that one for a second.
Yeah, so the newest one, the goal was to have, one of the most common questions I get is, how do you actually start to practice mindfulness? So I worked on this as a project to make it easier for people to incorporate mindfulness as a practice into their day-to-day lives with short 5-minute exercises that start to bring the practice into, again, to the day-to-day living. Mm-hmm. So that was the goal.
I love it, man. You're on a noble journey, and that's what I like, and that's what we like here at the show. We're all about bettering ourselves and providing value to those around us. So today I want to talk to you about mindfulness, which you seem to be very well versed on, attachment, which you cover a lot in your show, and compassion, and just kind of talk about how that all relates to Buddhism and your philosophy and your journey itself. So can you start there? Just kind of talk about your Buddhist journey.
Sure. So I first started studying Buddhism almost 10 years ago or so. And it piqued my interest. The more I learned about it, the more intrigued I was about the Buddhism as a philosophy, as a way of thinking. And during this time, I was kind of emerging out of another religious belief or view, and I wasn't very interested in acquiring a new religion or a new worldview.
Right.
So I had come across this notion of secular Buddhism, where the Buddhist concepts and teachings are presented in a secular format, more as a life philosophy, and I was really interested in that. And the more I studied it, the more I understood the nature of Buddhism in general as being quite secular in nature, as a non-theistic tradition. And again, I just, it was very interesting to me. I started reading a lot of books. The more I read, the more interesting it was, and the more I started to understand and correlate, like connecting the dots. I would read like one book that I'd be like, oh, 10 books ago, that concept now makes more sense because of how it's explained in this book.
Totally.
And that made me interested in trying to present it in a more concise way. I felt like it took a lot of roundabout going different ways to understand these concepts. And I felt like I wanted to explain it in a way that I would have been telling myself this the first time I encountered everything. So that was kind of the impetus for sharing Buddhism beyond studying Buddhism.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And the way you do present it is very colloquial, and like, you know, it's a very informal format, and it seems to work really well. And that's what's really cool about podcasting in general is people learn in different styles. Some people want, like a super highly produced, fast-paced show for their quick-thinking brain, but other people want a long-form, 3-hour Joe Rogan deep dive. So it's just really interesting that everyone presents this material and you present it well. But let's dive into your specific knowledge of the Buddha and Buddhism. What do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions when it comes to Buddhism? You know, sometimes you hear people say things like Buddhists can't be happy, or you can't own things, or it's about not being happy so you don't become sad. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I think the most common misconceptions I come across when somebody encounters Buddhism, especially coming from a Judeo-Christian background, they kind of draw the lines and parallels where the Buddha is the equivalent to God, and you know, they're looking for something, Buddhist writings or scriptures, to be the equivalent of the Bible.
Right.
But it's a very different approach. So some of the misconceptions are that the Buddha is a deity. That's a misconception. Others are that, you know, Buddhists try to live a very ascetic life and not strive for things, like no striving, or they're always confronting unhappiness, like life is unhappy or life is suffering.
Right.
And then perhaps another big one is the practice of Buddhism, meditation specifically. It's like it's this thing that you're supposed to sit and control your thoughts or quiet your mind, and eventually you have total control of what you're thinking. And those are all misconceptions about Buddhism, I think.
Let's dive into that then. So to begin, Buddhism is really heavily based around the practices. The reason that people from the Judeo-Christian religions look at it like that is because if you take a look at many of the other major religions, that is the case. You take a look at Islam and you go, oh, Muhammad is your Jesus. You take a look at the Jews and you say, oh, Yahweh is your God. So there's a lot of relations there, but Buddhism doesn't really fall into that. Is there even a creation story with Buddhism?
In some traditions, there are some metaphysical stories about realms.
Right, but there's no doctrine necessarily where
no, there's not.
Yeah, so it doesn't lay out the laws of the universe and the ways you should follow those laws. It's very unique.
Right.
It's unique in that sense.
Yeah, in fact, one of my first encounters with Buddhism that really piqued my interest was a world religion seminar that was presenting the answers to life's big questions through the filter of the five major world religions. And when it got to Buddhism, I was fascinated because the presenter said, okay, now Buddhism doesn't really have an answer to any of those questions. They're going to flip it on you and say, who wants to know, or why do you want to know?
That's cool.
And that was really fascinating to me to realize not only do they not have an answer, but they're just not interested in answering that question. It's almost like, why would you want to know that?
Right.
For me, that was a very powerful shift where I realized, yeah, why do I want to know that? That seemed more pressing than answering what is the answer. It was, where's the question coming from? And that was the start of my journey with Buddhism.
Right. And then you mentioned talking about, you know, striving, or let's call it accomplishment. We live in an accomplishment-based society, for better and for worse. America is a meritocracy, and it's an accomplishment-based society, and what a long way we've come running on that. But a lot of people think that kind of flies in the face of Buddhism, you know, like minimalist, non-attachment. But you're saying that's not always the case, right?
Right, that's not always the case.
Well, talk to me about that. How do you balance that kind of, I mean, you're a perfect example. You have a podcast, a technological media distribution system, and people want it coming out on a regular basis or at the same given times, but you're a Buddhist. How do you balance living in the USA in accomplishment mode with being a Buddhist monk?
Well, so rather than thinking of it as not striving or non-attachment, as a way of living where you don't strive for things, it's more about the relationship that you have to things. Like, let's use emotions, for example. If I'm trying to be non-attached to my emotions as I experience them, it's not about not having those emotions. It's about understanding that those emotions change. So when I am experiencing one, I don't have to latch onto it and try to make it permanent, because the nature of emotions is that they come and go.
Mm.
That same mindset with goals, with business, it's not saying that we don't want to have goals or milestones. It's saying we don't need to feel an attachment to them. In other words, we need to be able to pivot at any given moment. When the circumstances change, we pivot with those circumstances and adjust to the new set of cards before us.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be very helpful with as a business person, or you know, someone who strives with different goals and milestones that I try to accomplish in my life. I find that when the circumstances change in my life and it no longer makes sense to strive for that specific one, it's easier to say, okay, let's look at the, you know, the deck of cards I'm dealing with and re-strategize and now go in this new direction. So the ability to pivot has been much more helpful through practicing Buddhism rather than trying to stay stuck on something. And as you know, like, you know, that can be the death knell for a lot of businesses where it's like, no, this is the way the industry has been. We're not shifting. This is how, you know, people, Kodak, right? People want to use film. We're not shifting to digital, and you give it enough time. And because of the attachment to how things are, it could cause the end of that business or Blockbuster, or, you know, tons of other businesses that were not able to shift with the changing industry. I feel like for me as an entrepreneur, I try to keep that mindset of constantly analyzing the lay of the land and deciding where do we need to shift? Where do we need to adjust? Mm-hmm. Because that is the nature of reality, is that things are always changing.
Oh, I like that a lot. Yeah. And then bring that to your personal life kind of microcosm. That can be the death knell for a lot of people. If they get stuck in one mode of thinking and they don't ever become aware and conscious of that pattern and break that pattern, that can be a lifelong sentence.
Oh, absolutely. And it transitions very well to the mindset of a healthy relationship, you know, with a spouse or a partner, uh-huh. or the relationship that I have with my children as a parent. You know, I'm constantly reminding myself how things are right now. It's not how they've always been, and it's not how they'll always be. And it helps me to be more adapted to being skillful with how things are in this specific moment with my kids at this specific age, or with my wife, you know, with, it's so common to hear things like, oh, this isn't the person that I married. And it's like, well, no, absolutely not. And you're not,
that's not how it works. Yeah, totally. Either. That's a good point.
And so I feel like the practice of mindfulness and practicing non-attachment and permanence, all of that stuff has helped to help me to have a more skillful relationship with my spouse and with my kids and with my parents and everyone.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I wanted to touch on your last misconception that you mentioned, though. You said something about meditation in relation to thoughts. Talk to me mm-hmm. about the misconceptions surrounding meditation, meditation's relationships to thoughts, and also emotions.
Sure. So I think the most common misconception I encounter with meditation is that it's something that you do to change things. It's like, you know, I'm feeling this way, so I'm going to sit here and meditate until I don't feel this way. Almost like willing yourself to be at peace. Peace is a good example, right? In cartoons, anytime you see someone who's sitting there to meditate, they're like, come on, inner peace, come on, inner peace. Like you're trying to will yourself to be peaceful.
Right.
I think that's a misconception because the point of mindfulness meditation isn't to change. It's to be better at observing and sitting with whatever it is that you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. So if I'm experiencing discomfort and I'm trying to push it away, you know, there are a lot of ways to do that. I can distract myself. I can go do something. But meditation as a technique is saying, what if I don't have to do anything? What if I can actually just sit here with the discomfort and watch it, befriend it? And we're trying to do that with all of our thoughts and feelings and emotions. So rather than viewing meditation as a tool to change what I'm thinking or change what I'm feeling, it's saying, no, what you're practicing is being able to just sit with whatever arises and notice it and not have the impulse to want to change it, either to cling after certain feelings or to push away certain feelings. And it can be really useful for that because that the ability to do that sitting with your thoughts and feelings and emotions will affect your everyday life when you're in traffic and, you know, you're unhappy because a light just turned red on you and suddenly you can just sit with that discomfort and you don't have to react. That's where it really seems to be beneficial.
Yeah. You hit it on the head. I spoke with, Amita Chopra, she's a Harvard pediatrician, but she's also a meditation expert. And she said, the place that you'll generally start to see the benefits of meditation, that it shows up in the rest of your life. You don't start to feel amazing and have all these experiences. The first thing that you'll notice is it starts showing up in the rest of your life. And she was so spot on when she said that. I never forgot that. You know, I wanted to talk to you about attachment, though. It's a subject that you bring up a lot on your show. You know, like you said, it's ever important in the human psyche, and it's a big part of the Buddhist religion. So I want to talk about healthy attachment and kind of balancing healthy attachment versus unhealthy attachment, or just too much attachment, even if it's healthy. So let me give you an example. Like I spoke with Eric Kerr. He's an entrepreneur. He has a company called The Draw Shop. Everybody knows it. It's those info commercials where there's animation being drawn in front of you while someone's narrating. He's the guy who invented that. It's like the best way to communicate information or whatever. He wants to end addiction in the next like 15 years. And that's his goal, okay? He's working with these crazy biotech companies and all this stuff. He's really, really attached to that emotionally, spiritually, and it's part of his everyday life. And I hope he drives himself to that goal until he succeeds. But even something like that, you can drive yourself crazy and burn yourself out and shoot yourself in the foot and do all this stuff. So how do we preserve healthy attachment? How do we not let it go too far? How do we let go of the rest?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, with the concept of attachment, it's common to encounter people who, in their desire to not be attached, become attached to non-attachment. It's like, you know, like you can attach to anything, even meditation.
Oh, wow.
So one way I like to think of it, a big moment for me in my life was the realization of my attachment to a label that I had for myself. So I've always viewed myself as an entrepreneur. It's an idea that was instilled to me at a young age by my dad, mm-hmm. who was also an entrepreneur. And there was a phase in my life where I was facing the collapse of one of my companies. And I noticed how painful and distraught I was. It was a really hard experience. And I kept questioning why is this so hard? It's not a big deal. If a business goes under, they go under all the time. And I recognized it was the attachment that I had to my label of being an entrepreneur.
Mm.
And so the shift that happened was, I realized it's being an entrepreneur is not something that I am. It's something that I do. And there will be moments when I don't do it. Like this phase where the end of one company and you know, there was going to be an amount of time where it's not something that I do. And that moment of realization of attachment was very profound for me, because I think sometimes we think of attachment and it's opposite of detachment. So it's like, if I'm either attached to something or I should detach from that thing, that label or that idea or that emotion. And what Buddhism is actually presenting is something that's kind of in the middle. It's more of non-attachment, where it's saying, yeah, you can hold on to this thing, but it doesn't have to be with a death grip, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I can have my attachment to my ideas, my opinions, my thoughts, but I recognize that they're just that. They're thoughts and opinions and ideas. They're not me. And that's something I try to stress when I talk about this concept of non-attachment. You're not going to just get rid of your opinions and ideas and thoughts and emotions and the things that you strive for, like this example you gave. It's like, that's a good cause. But the more attached we are to it, where we identify as that thing is me, that thing owns me, there is a significant amount of self-inflicted suffering that arises from that, that wouldn't be there if we were non-attached to that thing, like still striving to accomplish that, but mm-hmm. recognizing if that thing doesn't pan out that way, that's not me. It's not, I'm not that thing, even though I work towards that. And I have things that I feel attached to. For example, one of the big things I do now is I love paramotoring and paragliding, and I teach it, and it's the Whoa. Thing that I do. You know, it's one of my big things. But I feel non-attached to it in the sense that I absolutely recognize that the day will come when I can't do it. I won't be physically fit enough, you know, maybe when I'm old, or if I were to get injured and break my legs or something, like I'm not going to be able to do this the way that I do it now. And I recognize this is something that I do. It's not who I am. So I feel like there's not this sense of attachment to the label of being a paraglider pilot. It's more of, that's just something that I do.
Right.
And that's made it a much more healthy relationship. So I think it's not about getting rid of our attachments, the things we're attached to. It's about shifting the relationship we have with our labels. Does that make sense, the difference between those two?
Totally. It's kind of a combination of, it's kind of like beliefs, like a belief perception, but it goes a little bit deeper than that, because it's tied to your actions as well and tied to your ego. And that's kind of what I was just thinking when you were talking about, you know, kind of your ego being hurt. Let's say your pride being hurt when your business fails and you're supposed to be this entrepreneur, right?
Right.
That's one of the seven deadly sins. I mean, if you take a look at the list of the seven deadly sins. I'm sorry, no, sorry about that. I'm confusing my commandments and my sins. But let's mix them all together, right? So it's all based around attachment, pride, mm-hmm. envy, coveting, theft. All of those things are based around attachment, right? All of the negative. So there's the light side. There's the virtues, right? Compassion, courage, things like that. And then on the sin, all of the dark side seems to be tied to attachment. If there was less attachment, you wouldn't need to covet. Your pride wouldn't be hurt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that kind of the Buddhist like thing that most, if not all, quote, sin stems from attachment?
Yeah. So the concept of sin from the Buddhist perspective, it's more along the lines of skillful and unskillful acts or practices.
I like that. That's great.
So in that sense, it's like, yeah, if I have, we would say like an ignorant view of myself as being something that I'm not, this would be my attachment to an idea, then I'm more likely to have an unskillful action or word around whatever that thing is, because I am viewing it from the wrong perspective.
Yeah, that's a limiting belief. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how that would be approached from the Buddhist perspective.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff, man. Let's move on to mindfulness, though. What does mindfulness mean to you, you know, at its core, if you had to define it?
So for me, mindfulness at its core is the ability to observe what's taking place in the present moment from a non-judgmental perspective. And I think that's the most important part. It's like, it's not just being present with whatever arises, it's also being able to observe that in a neutral way. For example, with my thoughts or emotions, an emotion or a thought arises and I can watch it, but I'm not caught up in judging it. This is a good thought. This is a bad thought. I shouldn't feel this way, or I should feel this way. You know, it's like you're putting your chair out on the front porch and you're just watching people watching, right? Or if you're watching the clouds, I think this is a good analogy. When you're watching the clouds, you just see what arises. Sure, you might be able to say, oh, that cloud looks like a rabbit, but you don't judge the clouds and say, oh, that's a good cloud, that's a bad cloud, that one's too fluffy or that one's too tall, because those concepts are, you know, it's almost silly to even think about that. What is a right cloud or a wrong cloud? There's no such thing. There's just what's there. And when we observe, mindfulness is that. It's observing what takes place in my sphere of awareness, but without the judgment of this is good or this is bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can kind of make your head spin at times. But I think you know mindfulness when you feel it. Do you feel like when you enter that state more and more, it's kind of like exercising a muscle?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the more you practice that non-judgmental observation, the easier it becomes to just be with whatever arises. You know, I've experienced this. I was leading a mindfulness retreat in Africa. And we were meditating, and one of the tasks was to just observe sound for a moment. And you could hear the sounds of all these incredible animals, like monkeys in the trees and elephants way out in the background, you know, like, and it was so easy for everyone to say, this is a pleasant experience because it's all novelty. And so what I brought up was, well, if we were at home doing the same exercise, or if we took someone from here and they came home with us and did the same exercise, they would marvel at the sound of the annoying train that just went by, or the cars that are honking on the street or the neighbor's dog that keeps barking, like all of that would be novel and unique to them. Yet we sit there and we're judging it. Oh, there's that sound again. I don't like that sound, but this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, and mindfulness practice is more about realizing that the incredible sounds you're hearing when you were over there in Africa are no different than the annoying sounds you hear in your apartment that you put up with every day and you think those are annoying. They're just sounds.
It's a really good point. I like that, man. It's a good way to frame that, that mindset.
Yeah.
Well, we love consciousness and here at Lifebook, and that's a big part of, you know, mindfulness. The first step is becoming conscious, I feel like, and then the second step is developing mindfulness. But in Lifebook, it's all about bringing consciousness to all areas of your life. You know, a lot of people say, what are my goals for 2019? Well, I want to get in shape and I want to make more money. Well, that covers two areas of your life, finances and health and fitness. Maybe some people go a little bit deeper and say, I want to be a better parent or I want to be a better husband. Now you're looking at parenting and love relationship. You know, but what about your character? What kind of character do you want to build? What about your quality of life? What about your spirituality? What about your social relationships? What about your life vision? The vision that you have for yourself and your life in the next year. Why don't you work on that? So that's my question to you. We bring consciousness to kind of obscure areas of life. What are your favorite areas to bring mindfulness to? Maybe like mindful parenting, or like I was saying, mindful financial practices. What do you like to bring it to in your life?
It's kind of interesting. The thing that I've tried to apply mindfulness the most is to the things that are unpleasant for me. For example, washing the dishes. You know, it's something that I don't enjoy doing. I never have. And yet it has to be done multiple times a day. There's no way around it. So I've taken it upon myself to make it one of my mindfulness practices. Like my job is to do the dishes. And I prefer that no one else in the family feels that because I've decided to make that my thing. And when I first started this several years ago, the goal was I'm going to do this until I like doing it. And I realized after a while, it's like, it's not working. I still don't like doing the dishes. And now that's been part of my practice where I just sit with it and think, why don't I like this? And why is it not changing? And after years of doing it as a mindfulness practice, I still don't like it. But I still benefit from the practice because that is my moment to sit with the emotion that arises, which is resistance to doing this. And here I am doing it anyway. And I've become more comfortable with the discomfort of having to do it. And I thought that's, you know, that happens a lot in life, that the things that you don't want to have to deal with, you can just deal with in spite of them being unpleasant because you become used to sitting with that unpleasant feeling, whether it's paying the bills every month when that day comes or, you know, whatever the thing is. So I feel like I look for those moments in my day-to-day living, the things that I tend to want to push away and wish I didn't have to do. And then I try to get better at sitting with that discomfort and saying, it's okay that I don't like it. The point isn't to learn to like it anymore. The point is to become more comfortable with the discomfort of having to do it. So that's one of the areas where I try to really practice mindfulness. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any suggestions for my listeners? Maybe some areas that have surprised you in the past that you brought mindfulness to that really were a game changer for you?
Yeah, I think so. Noticing what those when you decide that that's what you're going to practice, you start paying attention. When are these moments that I find that are unpleasant for me? Mm-hmm, and one of them for me has been recognizing that when I drive, you know, I don't like getting the red light, and I wasn't
rage?
Aware of that before. No, not road rage, but impatience. It's like, oh, seriously. But I didn't know that about myself until I started paying attention to where are the areas in my day-to-day living that I experience this discomfort, because those are the moments I want to try to practice mindfulness. So suddenly I realized, oh, I actually do get impatient when I drive. I didn't know that. I would have thought I was a pretty patient driver, but I was paying attention. Mm-hmm. And I've started to notice other areas where it's almost like I know myself now. These are the triggers that make me start to feel impatient or irritable that before I didn't know. And it was fascinating to think, how much of my life were those moments where I just would have been reactive and not even known it because it was habitual for me. At least now I can recognize that in myself. And for example, if I put on my jacket and I get in the car and I turn the heater on, I know that it's just a matter of minutes before I start to get into this like Hulk mode where I want to rip my jacket off because it's so hot. And that moment of feeling hot is one of my triggers. I didn't know that about myself before. And I thought, I wonder how often I lost my temper or was impatient with someone in the car without realizing that all I needed to do was detect the moment when that starts, take my jacket off, turn the heater down. And guess what? Now I'm a much more patient person, you know?
Yeah, that is very insightful. And that's the kind of stuff that mindfulness can bring your attention to. I mean, like you said, you might not think of yourself as a certain type of person until you really, I guess, detach and get a, is unbiased the right word, or an objective view, or just a more, you know, realistic view of yourself? And then you kind of have these revelations about yourself. Like you said, like, oh, I'm that type of person. You know what I mean?
Yeah. 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 And I think that unbiased view is, you know, that's mindfulness, right? We're trying to observe in this moment, what am I experiencing,
things,
but not judging
it. Yeah. Right. Right. Well, can you give my listeners some specific practices that they can walk away with? You know, you have your mindfulness journal seem to be the culmination of that, but I know you are a big fan of strategies and practices. So could you share some with us?
Yeah. One that I really like to practice, and it doesn't quite go with exactly what we've been discussing. It goes a little bit more along the lines of interdependence, which is another big practice. I like to, from time to time, I'll pause and I'll look around and I'll just ask, what did it take for this moment to arise? And you can pick it with a moment or with a specific thing. So for example, you might be sitting at your desk and then you can pause and just look down for a moment and look at the mouse, you know, or the keyboard and say, what did it take for this thing to arise? And it's almost like a mental exercise that only lasts 30 seconds or a couple of minutes, where you're thinking, what all did it take for this thing to become what it is? And I feel like those are moments where you can really feel connected to the countless causes and conditions that allowed that keyboard to suddenly just be sitting here. And I work on it and type on it as if it was no big deal. And in a way, it's like it took all of space and time for this thing to be sitting here on my desk. Mm-hmm. So that's a common one I do. I do that. That's the one I do when I'm in the car and I'm at a red light. I'll just pick something in my car and think, what did it take for this thing to exist? But I'll also do it with moments. You know, a certain moment in my day where I'll say, what all did it take for this moment to arise, or this feeling, or this thought, or this emotion? And it can be a really powerful grounding where you feel connected with everything. So that's an easy one. Just asking, what did it take for this thing to arise, whatever the thing is that you pick.
Do you feel that's related to gratitude? Is that the main sense that you get, or is it more of a not making yourself feel insignificant, but comfort in the grander scheme of things? What arises in you at that moment?
Generally gratitude. And I think it's worth emphasizing at this point, when we're talking about the positive concepts like gratitude or compassion, you know, we don't need to force these things. It's not like, hey, be grateful. Because if you're not grateful, you're just not grateful. You can pretend to be grateful, but but you're not grateful. From the Buddhist perspective, it's like you're trying to be aware of what is. Gratitude or compassion, these are things that arise naturally out of having a bigger perspective. So when you're practicing mindfulness, like this instance where I'm saying, what did it take for this moment to arise? It's fascinating to observe that the end result of that little mental practice is usually gratitude. But I never felt compelled to be grateful. It just arose naturally out of the insight of recognizing what all it took for this thing to exist.
But that's why I think it's a little bit different, is you can summon gratitude. You can actually summon gratitude relatively easily, especially if you're backed with like facts and history. Like if you do understand the past and you do understand relativity, That is what's crazy, is if you understand your life in relativity to the rest of humankind and human existence, if you have a realistic grasping of that concept and a realistic understanding of that concept, you can summon gratitude almost instantly. And one of the things we like to say in the Life Book is it's almost impossible to hold gratitude in your mind and any other thing simultaneously. It's really hard to be grateful and anxious, or grateful and depressed. So we really like to use it as a tool, and that's a good point, because it is a state, but it's it's way more summonable than, like you said, compassion. It's harder to summon compassion.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's just a little bit of a different flavor. It's not a character trait, and it's not an emotion. It kind of lives in between, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I mean, compassion is like a character trait tied to the emotion of sympathy, the emotions of sympathy and empathy. Would you, but I guess you can feel compassion too, but I kind of view compassion as more of a character trait. Would you not?
Yeah, I think it can arise naturally in a similar way that gratitude does, out of understanding. Like, the more you understand someone, the easier it is to feel compassion.
That's a good point. Yeah, the understanding part. And that actually segues nicely into my next question. Sorry if I cut you off. Finish your thought if you want to, you know, start the question that way. But I've been meaning to talk to someone about this riff that I've been kicking around in my head, because I talk about it all the time. We're on a huge upswing when it comes to the human, you know, species. Since the 1700s, our ability to have compassion for one another and build a better world has just been, I mean, since the Renaissance and before, let's be honest, has just been ramping up so quickly. Even in the past 100 years, there are studies that show that our compassion IQ and our empathy IQ are going up really, really fast. We're evolving as a species. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even since the 60s, going back just a couple decades ago, this huge movement of compassion, diversity, understanding, it's been drilled into us. It is the progress of humankind. And so we've all learned to recite that, and it's all in our head from when we were kids and the nice books they made us read and stuff. But it's hard to practice that when crap really hits the fan, okay? It's easy to be all cool and understanding, hey, man, your favorite color is red and my favorite color is green. Let's, you know, paint half the room red and half the room green, man. Awesome. It's all good. That's well and good. But when you're confronted with something or someone that goes against some of your deepest values, or something that you, like you just said, something that you just cannot understand, you can't relate to this person, right? This is the liberal looking at the Trump supporter, or the entrepreneur looking at Ocasio-Cortez. This is the perfect example of our political system right now. That's when compassion is most necessary. That's when compassion is the hardest to bring. And that's when people are completely failing in the realm of compassion. And what's really interesting is the easy route seems to be all the way in the other direction on the dark side. The easy route, the default route, the human route is to make that person look like a demon and an animal. Completely inhuman. They're completely unrelatable. If you're on their side, you're my enemy. I mean, it is the exact polar opposite of compassion. And that's when we need it the most, right?
Right.
So I feel like if we could all just do a little better job of that, a lot of stuff would happen. Do you feel like this is a real crisis of compassion? Do you feel like this is just a couple loud people at the top, and people in this country generally are good? What do you feel about compassion and all of those words and sentences that I just said to you?
I do feel like we're hardwired to seek connection and meaning and compassion. Mm-hmm. But we're also hardwired to detect the others, right?
There's teams,
us and them.
Tribes and teams, yeah.
And to identify with our team and to ostracize the other team. So it's almost like we're hardwired for both. And I think what's important, at least for me in my practice, I try to see myself in everyone else and recognize that in a very real way, I would be that person, whoever the person is, that when I feel that natural tendency to think, whoa, there's an other, there's a them. I remind myself, well, that's me. If I had been brought up that exact same way and had all the same experiences, everything that their life has, you know, led to this specific moment, that would be me. And that reminds me that, like, the tendency to want to make it to feel like it's impossible to see someone else as me. I try to remind myself, I could have been Hitler. I could have been whoever the worst person is out there, even if it's just someone who has different political views than me. Like, that could totally be me.
Mm-hmm. He was a human. Humans have been in a lot of different positions. Exactly. You have no idea what position you're going to find yourself in.
Yeah. And then I try to increase my understanding, like, what would it take for me to see the world the way that they do and to act or do the things that they do? And that's been a very helpful practice for me because I feel like it makes it so that I don't feel like we're enemies. We have different views. And so that's one side of it. The other side of it that I've tried to really focus on is to recognize that my views, especially my deeply held ones, like opinions or beliefs, political beliefs, religious beliefs, are just ideas. They're just ideas that I have. Mm. And when someone disagrees with my idea, it's not that they disagree with me. It's not that they hate me, even though they may think that they hate me. I view it as you just disagree with my idea. And it's just an idea. My idea that I hold isn't me. So you can attack my idea all you want, and I'm not going to feel personally threatened because at the end of the day, it's just an idea that I hold.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's been really helpful for me too.
Yeah. Well, what is the default that makes people feel that way? Is that a bit of a result of the trophy generation where you're super special and every opinion that you have, can affect the world and you can change the world and all this dream big stuff, did that kind of galvanize our one generation of children's beliefs onto their ego?
Possibly.
I'm not being derogative. Sure. I'm not taking a shot at that style of anything. I'm just saying that seems to be a side effect of that as we made our opinions and beliefs. I always talk about vote or die on this show. There was this big campaign when I was like 19. It was vote or die. And I'll never forget because it was P. Diddy. It was Puff Daddy, the rapper, coming on my screen, pointing at me and being like, vote or die. Like, you got to get out there. Like, you matter. And I just remember thinking to myself then and now, like why, Mr. Diddy? Like, why? Why do I need to vote or die? What if I don't like the political system? What if the political system gives me anxiety? What if I don't know a lot about the political system and I shouldn't be involved? Why should I vote or die?
Yeah.
So I feel like there was a lot of stress and gravity placed on a couple generations of children there. And I think that is why they can get personally offended by a disagreeing in what is essentially beliefs, which are replaceable glasses that we all wear.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's the over-identification with our beliefs where we think we
exactly.
are our beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is the flip side of that. We over-identify other people's views with their beliefs and we merge those two. And it's like, you take someone like Trump, for example, and it's like, well, if I disagree with everything with his political views and his beliefs, then I hate him. When in reality, he's not the same thing as his beliefs and views. So I may disagree with his views and have zero contempt or ill will towards him because he in a very real way is a victim of being attached to his views and beliefs in the same way that I am to mine. Mm. And he might look at mine and say, wow, yours are absolutely crazy. And I might look at his and say, well, yours are absolutely crazy, but we could still meet in the middle and say, well, isn't that crazy that both of us think that our views are all that? Like, what if we were non-attached to our views and my view mm-hmm. is just a view and your view is just a view and we can debate our views all day long, but we could be great friends.
You know, it's like I said, it's so easy to be compassionate when your fellow human barely disagrees with you, but it's when they make you sick to your stomach or they go against the grain where it's you have to say, this is another person, this is another human in front of me. And I think that can be challenging at times.
I want to emphasize that when we can see somebody as the person, non-attached to their views and their beliefs, it makes it easier, in my opinion, or in my experience, to have compassion arise naturally for that person. So one thing that I try to do is I try to know and befriend people who have different views than I do, whether those are political views or religious views. You know, I pretty much have friends on every spectrum of the political spectrum, and mm-hmm. and don't really have problems with those friendships. But for me, I do notice it's a little more difficult on the religious spectrum. I tend to mm. want to view the others as like the ones who have deeply held fundamental type views or absolute truth views, where it's like, this is the right way and your way is wrong. So I've tried to be more deliberate in my understanding of these people by befriending and opening those lines of communication, not with the intent to change each other's views, but just like understand each other a little bit more. And I think that's one of the big problems we have in our society today, is that we shy away from, you know, if you don't agree with me, then the best thing to do is let's not talk to each other, because I don't feel this hurt and you don't either. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's aggravating the problem. What if instead we could say, hey, we're not going to agree and we're not going to change each other, but let's at least talk and get to know each other and see where we have common ground, and recognize that it's okay to have differing views and still be friendly to each other. Mm-hmm. So,
or at least be in the same room without jumping down each other's throats.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's a good place to start, I feel like. Okay, everybody, you know what to do. Find the Secular Buddhism podcast, right? You're available all over the place right now.
Yeah, that's right.
And find the 5-Minute Mindfulness Journal, Noah's new release. Where can we send people who are interested in you and your work and your books?
So my personal website has my books listed, noahrachetta.com. And if you're interested in the podcast, that has its own website, secularbuddhism.com.
So, hey, man, I'd love to have you back on anytime. Any way I can help you and your show, just please let me know. I'm at your service.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for the invite to be on your show.
Of course, man. All right, everybody out there, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time on the Life Improvement Podcast.